folks, it's Spoiler in Time, the show where Brian Brushwood and myself, Tom Merritt, do a look at the things we've been watching thanks to the technology that we talk about on Cord Killers. On this episode, we will talk about Firefly, Episode 1, Serenity, Game of Thrones, the season premiere of Season 7, War for the Planet of the Apes, and Baby Driver. But first, Brian, how are you doing?
Dude, I'm the best ever. But more importantly, let's check in on the summer movie draft!
Kind of one of my favorite tunes right now.
Why? Because you're in number one by a long shot?
War for the Planet of the Apes only made $56 million. Boom, boom.
Okay. Oh, so you're strutting around cock of the walk because your only threat to supremacy was Big and Tall, who's at $460 million. You're sitting at $720, and their last movie came out. War for the Planet of the Apes was, I think, by all measure, a very strong opening weekend for rated R feature.
Sure. For sure. Not a disappointment, but I was worried it would overperform, and then I would feel extremely threatened. I don't think I'm out of the park yet. Out of the park? I think I'm out of the woods yet. I turned the woods into a park already. That's, I'm counting my chickens before they hatch. Okay, then I'm putting them in a park. And all my metaphors are getting mixed up. But what I'm saying is I'm feeling pretty good, Brian.
Yeah, you are safe at $720 million. You're congratulations. You're the champion of the summer. But like now, Justin and I have to be worried about our silver medal because we're at basically 560. Big and Tall is at 460. So we have a $100 million lead. They still have the rest of the run of Spider-Man Homecoming and War of the Planet of the Apes.
Which Spider-Man's going to top 300 probably.
By the way, has Atomic Blonde come out yet?
Nope. No, not yet.
Oh, dude. No. Yeah. Look, you're the champion.
That's why if War had made 70 to 80 million in its open weekend, I would be worried. But right now, making 56 million, just that gap probably keeps it low enough that Atomic Blonde can give me any padding I might need.
By the way, let's talk about Atomic Blonde. They finally turned on the marketing machine for this one.
I noticed that.
Saw the trailer. Hoo golly.
That's a good trailer.
It's a great trailer.
With the personal Jesus black skinheads match.
Yes. And it's sexy and high intensity and fast paced. And Charlize Theron, I think we all really enjoyed her performance in Fury Road. And to see her essentially Furiosa in the 21st century, It's going to be a blast.
I tell you what, and I don't want to give Team Frogpants short shrift, although they are in last place, but Dunkirk is probably going to do well, too. It's getting a ton of buzz, and I can't wait to see it. That's the movie that's coming out this week, along with Your Own Girls Trip and Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. Which
yeah, man,
is a
Girls Trip Fever, catch it. It's going to win us the game.
Catch it in your wherever.
It's going to outperform Atomic Blonde plus $200 million, I'm sure.
Yes, it is.
It has important
just keep
information
thinking
about
that.
It does have important information about booty holes. It's a public health service film.
So it's in booty hole fever, but you can't get a fever.
I don't think it should be taken as medical information.
Okay.
All right. Shall we move on and discuss Baby Driver?
Yeah, man. Let's take it in. Can we start with all the things I loved about this movie? I got dangerously close to talking it out with Justin during the Weird Things podcast. But... I loved the things that were absolutely unquestionably objectively great about this movie. Number one, it took place at Dragon Con, if not the time, totally, at least at the place. I recognized all the hotels, everything
even
I recognized.
Even the street scenes that I didn't actually recognize, I'm like, well, that's totally downtown Atlanta, though. It just has the feel.
Exactly. Yeah. Second of all, I love the conceit of, you know, involving music. Like they gave a reason for music. There's a theatrical conceit that when he's listening to songs, the world just seems to sync up with the song, which is a lot of fun. The chase scenes are fantastic, and I know it's very complicated and difficult to do a good stunt-based chase scene. However, and all of the talent is great, and they all do a great job of executing on it. But the characters and the writing, Justin pointed out that this and Scott Pilgrim are the only Edgar Wright pieces that were not co-written by Simon Pegg.
Mm-hmm.
And as this and Scott Pilgrim have very similar process oriented feelings to them, where like, well, now it's time for the next straw man to be knocked down or whatever. And I felt that a bit during this show. I did not emotionally connect with a single character. I did not believe it when, and we're in spoiler territory, so I could say this.
Yeah, yeah.
When Frank Underwood would randomly says, oh, what the hell? I was in love once, and then decides to lose his life. A guy who, you know, they spend 2/3 of the movie establishing as a money-grubbing person who has strict standards, suddenly decides to throw it all away because a kid's in love. I didn't believe it when Don Draper just suddenly is like, but I'm really mad. That's why I should be your nemesis for this final scene. Didn't believe any of that. I didn't believe any of it. I never felt anything, which is a bummer, because among the things they did in this movie was they referenced the one song, like Bonnie and I don't know if I've ever told this story publicly, but remember that bit where they were talking about the Beck song, Deborah?
Mm-hmm.
That song, it's in Beck's, third album, I think, Midnight Vultures. And it's kind of so awful in theme, because it's about a dude who can't even remember the name of the chick that he's hitting on. And all he could talk about is how he wants to bang her and her sister. Right. Bonnie and I had a friend who rented out a roller skate arena at one point. And one of the things we did, we're like, oh, wouldn't it be hilarious if we did couple skate? And you're like, oh, what would our song be? And we're like, I don't know, Deborah. And that was so hilarious to us that I ran out to my 1992 Toyota Tercel and grabbed the CD, and they played Deborah while we skated. And we laughed the entire time, and in so doing, made that an actual meaningful song to us. It kind of became our song because it was hilarious.
That's great.
On paper, this should be my favorite movie of all time. In execution, I just didn't love anybody, and I didn't care about anybody and all of the twists. I didn't even love the cars, because I kept almost loving the cars, but in 5 seconds he would find another one. It started to feel like just watching someone else play Grand Theft Auto, and that was a bummer.
Well, I'm not sure you left me much room to mention anything, to be honest. Like,
I mean, sorry. I've had thoughts. I've had a week to think about this before getting to this.
This is a common theme where if you don't connect, how do I phrase this? You will dislike a movie more than me because you don't feel like you connected with the characters. That or TV shows too. That is very important to you, to feel a connection with the characters.
I would say of the two of us, you are better equipped to appreciate the vignettes and individual set pieces on their own cinematography merit.
Yeah, okay, maybe. I don't know if I'm equipped.
I
think I'm more forgiving of things.
Correct.
I excuse things. And so when you're talking about, and the reason I bring this up is when you talk about Frank Underwood suddenly saying like, well, screw it, I was in love once. Like, I totally get on paper what you're saying. I'm like, yeah, that has not been set up very well. But when I was watching the movie, I thought, oh, well, he probably knows he's going to die anyway, right? So he's faking it. That's what he does as a character. He fits his emotions to the situation. And so that's what he's doing. Don Draper the same way, where it's like, oh, okay, well, he is really angry. He was very protective of her, so he's getting unusually angry. And did they hint at this and point to it earlier? No, and you're right to point that out. None of that mattered to me, though. I excused it as I was watching it. The reason I found this on my scale, I found this amazing, was this. I saw the U.S. trailer and I said, boring car chase movie. I saw the U.K. trailer or the European trailer, and I thought, oh, OK, there seems like there's more going on here. My wife saw it at South by Southwest and raved about it. And so going into the theater, I should not have been impressed. I was set up like my expectations have been raised here by Eileen. I have mixed feelings about the trailer. Let's just see. And it blew me away because it subverted my expectations. Like you said, the music was great. The connection of the music was great. And what surprised me the most, it has nothing to do with character, has nothing to do with plot. I enjoyed the car chases, and I hate car chases. Car chases are when I get up and go to the bathroom. Car chases when I'm in a theater is when I kind of drift off. I'm like, okay, when are we going to be done with this? I loved every one of these. There was a narrative happening in the car chases that I never usually see.
Yeah. No, I will agree with you. I did not experience the same journey as you, but I in no way doubt your logic or where you ended up there. Like I believe I think you and I got on the same roller coaster with a different expectation as far as favorite parts, and yeah. You got more of your favorite parts and I got less of
that's my a perfect parts. Way to put it. Yeah. Because I'm not disagreeing with any of the parts you didn't enjoy. They just weren't as important to me.
Correct.
You're absolutely
correct.
Right.
Yeah. I think Bryce nailed it in the chat. He says Baby Driver felt like a storybook.
Yeah, there are some movies like the Neon Demon did this for me, where it's like you have a lot of you. There's like a layer of separation between what's happening and the exposition of it, right? Like the idea of him walking up and down the street and the music and like. That's a very fanciful way of showing that, you know, all of the different crew members in these heists are very fantastical and very briefly there. And so on some level, you almost like the best way I could read it was as a very mythical sort of idea. Right. I mean, you have this young kid who's a prodigy and he's in this wild journey. And so that fantastical element is a good way of calibrating sort of a perspective on Baby Driver. And I think through that lens, it's better. Because I had some connection issues, too. I walked out of it and like, oh, that love story stuff. Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, that happened, but that was also very truncated and you know.
Random side jag. I absolutely adore the emerging phenomenon of subverting our expectations as far as subtitles that happen. We grew up with, you know, 30... plus years of whenever something, you know, non-audio was happening, there was a particular place all of that had to show up. But nowadays, I love the selection of fonts, the fact that it's placed in places.
Not subtitles
screen.
Per se, but titles, right?
Yeah. Correct. Well, and you saw.
Because when you said subtitles, I was thinking like closed captioning. But you're, yeah.
No, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Because when he talks to his father figure and he's using American Sign Language.
No. But I was like, wait, but you watched it at a theater. How did you have closed captioning on? That's what confused me.
You're talking about
when they're interpreting for you.
Yes.
And then they put it in the scene. I thought that was really cool too.
Yes. And you know, I don't know. I enjoy that is part of the. Artistic toolbox that people are using for movies now.
Well, and I think the fact that it's subverted expectations in a lot of ways is what makes this movie fun for me, because you have an old deaf black man who has fostered a young white man who has hearing problems, right? So they have a bond. You have a guy who either is going to get his comeuppance and lose the girl, or he's going to get the girl, have neither happen. He goes to prison for a while and she waits for him, right? It's not where you would normally go with those in the classic movie trope. So I enjoyed those small bits about it as well.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. What are you thinking? Should we go to war?
Yeah.
For the Planet of the Apes?
Hey, Tom.
Yeah.
You want the good news?
What's the good news, Brian?
Dark Tower still might be the third best Western of 2017.
Because War for the Planet of the Apes is not a Western, is it?
Oh, my gosh. Are you kidding me? It's clearly a story of cowboys and Indians. It's clear about the indigenous peoples running around. Yeah, one of them gets
destroyed.
We are
the indigenous people, though.
Whatever. I mean, as far as tracking and mapping, I think.
All right.
So it's clear that this is pretty much an Indian story of a bad Union general attacking, raping, and killing a village.
Well, he even mentions Custer at one point.
Yeah, right. I mean, they wore it on its sleeve. This is a straight-up revenge tale, and it was wonderful. I loved it. I thought it was so good. How about you?
Baby Driver was amazing. First amazing since I came up with my scale. War for the Planet of the Apes was good. Did not quite get to great for me. And Eileen and I kind of felt the same way about this one. We don't always. we love the first half quite a bit. The journey, the revenge, the discovering of the girl. Once you get to the camp, though, I felt on rails. I felt like I knew where it was going. And every time I thought it was going somewhere, that's where it went. That said, the way they executed it was good. So I wasn't disappointed or rolling my eyes, but I kept waiting to be more surprised than I never was.
I think we're actually on the same page on that. I don't know if I've ever told you my defense of the movie Cars. Cars is straight up just Doc Hollywood told by Pixar.
Yeah, I think you have mentioned that
before. Yeah, but a familiar song is no less extraordinary when performed exquisitely, right? This yes. is a straight up familiar conceit, as you called it, the Great Escape or Escape.
I was sitting, just a side note, I was sitting in the theater as they're going through the tunnels trying to figure out how to get the apes out. And I'm like, oh, it's like the Great Escape. And then like escape. I didn't do it on purpose. And then I start chuckling to myself like yeah. Great Escape.
It's a familiar song, right? We've all heard it. But that in no way takes away. So On Rails is, I think, also an accurate descriptor in that it's a familiar song. We know when the chorus is going to hit and we're familiar mm-hmm. with all the beats on it. But all of that being the case, it was still exquisitely performed. It's the best performance of this song I've ever seen. And it was done with so much uphill stuff. And there was part of me that couldn't disengage from the idea of thinking, oh, wow, if I was a multinational conglomeration of corporations, it seems to me that this would be a great franchise because how cheap is it to just replace subtitles for all of the sign language being performed right now on screen?
Right.
But the bigger part of me was a kid who was like, wow, how much emotion and very human aspects of human, ironically in air quotes, is being expressed here, purely through CGI and the incredible storytelling ability. I loved Monkey C-3PO that we met, comic foil relief man.
Yeah. Right.
I just loved it.
Bad ape.
And I found myself, to my own amazement, impressed with the acting of Woody Harrelson. This might be the best acting I've seen from Woody Harrelson maybe ever.
Hmm.
Like, I bought it in a way that I don't think
more
I
so
bought
than
him.
True Detective.
No. True Detective, he was sublime. This okay. he was very good in. How about that?
Yeah. No, he was good. I also thought they were a little heavy-handed with message on a couple of notes. Not most of the time. Most of the time, it was just a pretty straight story. But, I mean, they had a moment where the flag that had been hanging up started burning, and they closed in on it. And there was a few other bits and pieces here and there like that. But most of the time, it was not very heavy-handed. And telling, like you said, a straight-ahead story. And I really enjoyed Woody Harrelson's character, too. I knew he was going to end up, as soon as he starts talking about hating the people, you know, killing the people who get the disease because, and it happened at my child. I'm like, oh, that's how he's going. He's obviously going to get this disease. So I get that. But again, like you're saying, a masterful execution of that song by him and right. Andy Serkis.
Like and you can totally ding it for being way too familiar. But guess what? It's a remake. No. It's not even a remake. It's a sequel to a remake of a story that is super old. So as a result, I didn't mind those moments like when they showed us the origin story of Nova's name and so on. And yes, it's silly and cheesy. And
Cornelius,
it's
right? That was kind of, I kind
of
liked that.
I loved all of that. Yeah. I loved all of that. And so in that regard, yes, it feels a bit Rogue One fan fiction-y, you know, past worship. But unlike that, it was light on those and stood well on its own terms. And I enjoyed it.
All right, let's move on to the Game of Thrones episode 1 of season 7, or as some others prefer that I say, episode season 7, episode 1, wherein I have to say, other than the hounds scene, everything was punching in this opening. Like, we were getting the beats that you would want. Usually they hold on to a few of those. And if anything, it has me a little worried about where we go next. or very excited because it's like, dude, if you spent all that ammo in episode one, what else you got for me this season?
That is astonishing to hear from you because I think you've put into stark relief somehow between the different properties we've talked about. I think we've discovered a fundamental difference that we have in our tastes. I thought the Hound stuff may have been my favorite part of the entire thing. Like,
I could totally see that. I'm just saying, like, that was not the big event bit. That was when they finally said, let's pull it back and do an interesting character piece.
Right.
There was no revelation there.
So the opening scene is just straight up candy. It's like, hey, welcome to the candy store. Here's some candy, right? That was satisfying. And
apparently they didn't have that as the opening scene originally. And when they went back and were looking at the cut, they're like, Hold on, we need to open with that.
Yeah, this stands alone. And it really does. It's great because one of the things I love most from television and movies and when it makes me feel slightly adrift and I'm not sure of my footing. That's very much what it did. Like, is this a flashback? Is this a solid? And then that slow dawning realization of like,
as they pour wine and you're like, wait a minute, he's going to poison them. But why would he do? Oh, he's not him. Yeah,
exactly. That was so satisfying and so fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And the scene where Daenerys comes to the beach and there's no words spoken. She just puts her hand down because you know this is the moment that she has been dreaming of. If you watched the previously on, they kind of hammered that at you. But even if you didn't, you know the story. Like, she has been dreaming of this moment for a while. Maybe not even all her life, but this has been her quest.
You know, what's funny is for me, maybe I was a little too introspective during that moment because I was like, I could tell that this meant something to her, but I was not feeling much in that moment. Although weirdly, that moment, like, you know, they talk about Dragonstone. Look, there's a lot of places to remember, a lot of characters to remember, a lot's happened over the last 6.5 seasons or whatever. But that moment that she goes upstairs and you see the room and you recognize the table and you're all like, Stannis had sex on that table. You know, it's like that was a cool moment of realizing.
And those pieces that are knocked over, we know why they got knocked over.
That's right. There's something about this, the familiarity of this. We're seeing an element that we have never seen here before. And it's like, to be honest, it's roughly the feeling of walking downstairs and finding Daenerys in your living room. Like, this is a known space that I've been before. What are you doing here? This is weird. So weird that you're here. And it felt that way the entire time, right?
Yeah. In the greatest way. I think a couple other scenes, you know, that stand out. Cersei kind of finally confronting Jaime that she's in charge. And she doesn't care if she's surrounded. She doesn't care if Jaime makes sense that, you know, the odds are against you right now. She's going to be defiant. That's definitely going
to
set the tone.
To be honest, like, there ain't no reason Cersei shouldn't feel that way because the evidence bears out. She's been right 100% up till now. It works out in the end.
Past performance is no guarantee of future.
That's true.
Success,
that's true.
Yeah.
But how much did you enjoy, I don't know, the guy, I forget the guy's name from the islands, from the Iron Islands showing up.
Oh, Euron.
Euron seducing her.
Kind of a jerky boy to her. And, you know, I feel like that's the right play with Cersei, to be honest.
Well, and the way he drops, like, right there in court with everybody looking, including her brother, it's like, yeah, plus I got two hands. What do you think? You like
just
this?
Saying. Did the musical warrior bother you when Arya stopped at the campsite?
Oh, yeah. I saw chatter. Truthfully, I would never have recognized Ed Sheeran if it were not for all the outraged Twitter.
And did you
chatter.
Know it before you saw it or after?
I did know it beforehand. I was like, oh, I wonder if the reaction makes me think that he did a bad job. But then it got to that moment and I'm like, oh, this must be the guy they're talking about. And instead, I thought he was great.
Yeah.
Look, that's not a rocket science role that he played. I thought it was fine.
I got a theory on this, and this doesn't really bear on the quality of the episode, but Eileen had watched it while I was watching Twin Peaks. So she was watching it again over my shoulder while I was watching it. And I had not seen any of the stuff. I didn't even know he was in there. And she goes, do you recognize him when he started singing? And by the way, he's singing a song from the book, you know, the about Jamie's hands, about the, you know, hands of gold.
Hands of gold. Wait, what? Is it about his hands? Because I got the impression that the song predated. It was just preternaturally appropriate in that. Because you remember it's
Tyrion. You know,
it's
you Tyrion. May be right. I don't remember the timeline, but it's not a song that Ed Sheeran made up.
Right.
That they made up for the show.
Right. But if I remember correctly in the book, Tyrion is thinking of that song as he chokes, what's her name, Shay, with the gold chain of hands, right?
So he's singing, and Eileen's like, "Do you recognize that?" And I wouldn't have, because I wasn't thinking. I didn't care. I was like, "Oh, a guy is singing a song. That happens in Game of Thrones." And I'm like, "Holy crap, that Ed Sheeran?" And she's like, "Yeah, it is." After that, I couldn't not see him in every scene, because I'm thinking to myself, "Wow, how cool is it if you're Ed Sheeran and they cast you in this, and you're a singer and you're a big fan, and you're like getting all this FaceTime because you're sitting right next to Arya," and it did distract me from the scene. The scene wasn't so important that it like ruined it for me or anything, but I was like, he was constantly in every shot. And I think that may be what drove people a little crazier than they would have otherwise, because it wasn't just one shot of Ed Sheeran singing and then we're off with Arya talking to the other people. It's he's next to her in every time you see Arya, you see Ed Sheeran as well.
So to be clear, I am very, very guilty of being the guy crabbing about this in every other property, but even a broken clock is right twice a day. In this case, I happen to be standing in the one part of the field not struck by lightning. I'm going to mix up five more metaphors and just say it came and it went, and I noticed not a thing, and I thought he did a fine performance and didn't mind one whit that he was in it, which if I had more baggage going into it, I probably would feel very different.
Jon Snow's scene with Sansa early on, maybe not as revelatory either, but it set the dynamic between Jon and Sansa. And I feel like Sansa is important for Jon, not because he needs to listen to her advice so much as having a trusted dissenting voice helps solidify his decision. If Sansa hadn't been there giving Jon a chance to defend himself, there'd been a bunch of people in that room thinking it, and it might have undermined him.
So where do you think we're headed in a world where Littlefinger, the one guy who's always played all the angles, like Littlefinger has never been wrong about one thing ever the entire series long, which makes me very tuned in to the fact that he seems extraneous and ineffectual and desperately clawing for some purchase, for relevance in the current dynamic.
And his calculations are based on the Sansa of seasons 1 and 2, not the Sansa we have now, who is changed quite a bit.
But also,
my guess is he is going to miscalculate because he doesn't understand Sansa fully and get his comeuppance.
That is a possibility. However, let's remind ourselves that the Sansa that we have today was built by Littlefinger. Like, Littlefinger is the one that made her the person that she is today.
When she left Littlefinger, she was but a learner. Now she is the master.
Maybe she is. That's hard for me to believe. But maybe it is. Dude, did you notice that we saw some stuff in the Sam Tarly stuff that we've never seen before? In the
there's some stuff in that Sam Tarly stuff that I didn't want to see, but yeah.
Okay, number one, that's brilliant to show that basically his whole life is pouring soup and scooping soup up, right?
And that there's hardly much difference between the two when you really think about it.
But the pacing of that, where it was fast, hard cuts or whatever.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Never seen that. That was Baby Driver editing.
Yeah,
we saw Baby Driver.
No, it was.
You got Baby Driver in our Game of Thrones. When did that happen?
You got Game of Thrones in our Baby Driver.
Right.
Yeah. No, I hadn't even thought about that. You're right. I actually kind of did think about it as Baby Driver, but I hadn't thought about the fact that that is undone. That is not done in Game of Thrones.
Well,
it was
and
entirely
plus also, the only thing that comes close in my mind is that time that I was unfairly annoyed with the Celtic rock song in the end credits. Like,
oh, right.
That's the closest to that we've ever seen before was this is very contemporary. Whoa.
Yeah. Well, and Jim Broadbent showing up, I thought was going to be something that would throw me out of it because he is such a character, especially in Harry Potter, who's very much a, you know, Jim. When you see Jim Broadbent, you're like, hey, that's Jim Broadbent, or at least I do. He didn't. I almost didn't realize that was Jim Broadbent at first. And I thought his play of that was masterful. Like I was like, I believe that no, he was no longer Jim Broadbent. He was the maester who might actually be the one to help Sam, but there's going to have to be some work done.
JC Calhoun, I think, nailed it in the chat. He says he found the montage kind of jarring. It was well done and fun, but off brand, which is exactly my complaint about that moment. They did the Celtic rock thing when they chopped off Jamie's hand. How about that moment when Jorah Mormont, who we do not see, we just see a hand. Did you recognize the voice?
Well, no, I didn't, but I was slowly putting it together when Eileen says, "Hi, Jorah," over my shoulder.
Oh, like, no. That to be honest, Bonnie was the same thing. The moment she heard the voice, she was just like, "Oh, is that him?" And I'm like, "Who?" And then all the bricks fell into place. I was like, "Oh, that's amazing."
Yeah, yeah. I think there's more to, and we don't know it from the books. I think there's more about Dragonscale than we understand. I think there's going to be something to that.
I didn't even think about that. The idea that maybe it's called Dragonscale because it builds an affinity with a dragon, or
you catch it from dragons, or you, something. I don't know.
You give it to dragons. I don't know. In general, to be honest, I'm going to rate on a sliding scale because in general, the first episode tends to be table setting. This very much was. And again, of the two of us, I think I loved the setting up of the redemptive arc of the Hound, maybe more than anything else in this entire story right now.
Something
about that actor, something about the horrific nature of that character, something about the pain that he's been through and the fear that he's standing up to. Beric Dondarrion's a weird element. There was a hot second there. I thought they were going to introduce Lady Stoneheart. But
no, Beric Dondarrion. I am convinced at this point that Beric Dondarrion is Lady Stoneheart. Like that mantle will be carried by him with entirely different.
It would be way too confusing to set it up at this point. But I thought if you were ever going to do it, you could make it a standalone vignette at this moment, and they bypass that exit, and that's fine. But in general, still exquisite storytelling. Very much enjoying it.
Agreed. All right. Let's finish up with our new library show, Firefly. We will be watching these in production order, which is the order that Joss Whedon meant them to be aired in. Fox did not air them in that. That's a whole separate story. But this means we're starting with episode Serenity, not the movie Serenity, the episode Serenity, which is the episode where we meet Shepherd Book and we meet Simon, and we even meet Simon's sister as they all board the Firefly. This is the introduction to all the characters.
Before we begin, Bryce, have you watched, what's your experience with this series?
I watched Firefly. I probably watched it twice. The first time I watched it was in college watching the DVDs. So they were in this exact order.
That was sort of the initial thrust when you heard the buzz, like, there's this thing, it's a crime, it didn't get picked up, check it out.
Something like that. Or a friend just kept pushing the DVDs on me, and then I ended up watching them, yeah.
So you have not taken a fresh eye to them?
No, probably not in five or more, probably about 5 years? It's been a while.
Allow me to formally invite you to join us on this expedition.
Oh, sure,
because there's
sure.
a lot of weird stuff that I didn't expect to pick up. Not the least of which is cheap show.
A Fox sci-fi show
that
you
answered everything.
Cheaper than I remember it. Cheaper than you remember it. Cheaper than anybody listening to the sound of my voice remembers it.
You say so.
You don't think so?
I have no perspective on that because I've continuously watched all of these episodes over and over every year since they aired. So to me, it looks exactly like it did the first time, right? It's like seeing your child grow up. Well, except that this doesn't grow, right? But seeing someone every day, you don't notice the changes. Whereas if you haven't seen something in 5 years, you're like, whoa, wait a minute. I don't remember it being like that.
The biggest surprise from a purely mechanical standpoint of revisiting it, and I think I've made five laps through this whole story.
And also, this was like the pilot episodes, and pilots tend to be cheaper even than
correct, the whole series, yeah.
And it's also 2002, I think, right?
Yeah, 15 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Two things struck me. Number one, hot damn, does Nathan Fillion never age? Never, like, he's still, how was he 42 17 years ago?
Yeah.
But the other thing was, and I have an increased perception of this kind of stuff now that we do production for Scam School and Monorogue and so on, but they have an aesthetic of over the shoulder handheld cameras. And as a result, by current standards, just everything is shaking constantly, which does give you an upgrade. Like, that is a benefit.
It's also the style then. I mean, that a lot of shows were playing with that style still.
Right. We saw that
MTV
on The Shield.
Sort of pioneered in the 90s. Yeah.
Right. And again, I'm not saying bad or good, but it's like, I did not notice it the first four laps through, but I very much notice it in 2017. It's like, it's as though they were wearing hot pink and turquoise. And I'm like, I know what decade this was made, you know?
Okay. But let me ask you story wise, because I don't notice that crap for the most part, unless it's really standing out. It just doesn't hit me. Story wise, did anything hit you that you hadn't noticed?
Yeah. Knowing how everything wraps up with the story of the Reavers, knowing future episodes where they sketch out the long shadow of the Reavers and make them as terrifying as possible. Like, the first time you watch this through, you're like, oh, I don't know, bad guy pirates, I guess they're afraid of.
Yeah, disposable bad guy of the week, right? Yeah.
But instead, it really holds up, knowing the full weight of what they're encountering and the believable way that they get out of the situation where they're faced against the Reavers, and the believable weight of the backstory between Patience and Mal. And I even loved the realization that the whole time what you thought were bars of gold that were valuable turns out it's foodstuffs, and that just recategorizes stuff. Also, knowing the future, that moment that the Fed takes River as a prisoner, kind of hilarious in that moment where she's acting like a victim, and you're like, man, you don't even know what you're holding. What are you doing? What are you doing?
She's going to wake up here in a minute.
Yeah, you don't take a nuclear bomb prisoner. What are you doing?
Right. And you could tell that Joss Whedon is planting seeds for all kinds of things that you only recognize later, and you may not have even appreciated at all if you'd only ever watched this thing through once. And that's one of them. Is I remember the first time I watched through this thinking that River was just, you know, she was Simon's younger sister and super smart. She was the geek, right?
Right.
And you don't get too many hints of what else is happening with her character in the future.
Yeah. The other moment that struck me was the moment that the director of the show gets in on the joke that Malcolm Reynolds is telling. Malcolm Reynolds, out of nowhere, delivers an impassioned story, and then the final sentence is, Kaylee's dead. And then, and this is a character just wanting to mess with this dude and spin him for a ride. But instead, like, the director gets on board and suckers us as well with using tropes that mean, no, this really happened. Slow motion,
yes,
running up
even
the stairs.
Now. I've watched this thing 20 times more.
Yes.
I'm still like, she's not really dead, right? I mean, I know she's not really dead, but yeah.
And then that moment to snap, all for nothing more than a cheap laugh. And I kind of adore them all the more for having done it. Kaylee is the real star of the entire show. Jewel State is just a magical, wonderful human being. I met her briefly at Dragon Con, and is every bit of her fame well deserved, and she's so great in the show.
Yeah, and I always feel incumbent to remind people what Jewel State tells people on many of her social profiles. She is not that character you know her from television as.
No.
She is an actor,
right.
And really good.
She's like, I am not the marionette. I made the marionette. And that's great. That means you're a talented, wonderful person.
You know what? I am going to backtrack a little bit on the cheap factor because my brain's working here a little bit. I remember this is the arc of having watched this thing as many times. I remember watching that opening scene in Serenity Valley and thinking how great that was. We were seeing a whole battle scene. And then feeling a little depressed, not depressed, but feeling a little like, oh, but I guess we're just going to be on the Firefly from now on. There's not, this isn't all about battles. And of course that seems silly now because we all know, but, then watching it maybe four or five times later, seeing that Serenity Valley scene and going, man, I remember this being a lot better. Like, you can tell this is a soundstage.
That's the moment that I had. And what's funny.
And then, but then let me just finish this up real quick. Then after watching it many more times, just getting forgiving about it and saying like, yeah, all right. But, you know, look at Mal, look at the building of the characters that we have going on. And this is going to pay off in so many ways. I don't really care that it looks like a soundstage. And I just forgot about that. So maybe that's why I'm being so dismissive of that, is I've worked through that reaction already somehow.
There's a great moment in the director's commentary track, because that's on my second lap. I did the director's commentary and all that stuff. And I think it's Joss and Nathan Fillion are talking through that scene in the moment. And Nathan Fillion is so proud. He's like, watch this. And he goes, see that squib? See that explosion? He goes, I never blinked. Awkward pause. And then Joss says, actually, you did. We had to digitally edit that.
Which, by the way, with Joss Whedon, I still don't know if that's true or not. Or
maybe he said it because it was the right thing to twist. Yeah. Also, unsuccessful at getting either of my daughters to watch it. It's amazing.
Really?
Yeah. I tried very hard to sell them on the idea of it. And I, you know, they know how much they enjoyed Avatar and Korra. So when I say, this is as good as those things, you would think they would hop on board. But teenagers, what can you do?
Yeah, right? Yeah. Still love that moment where they open the box and it's strawberries and you realize what a different world this is, where fresh strawberries are gold.
Here's another thing is, remember 15 years ago when it was novel for people to blend foreign languages in English as if
it was huge, right? That felt exotic
at the time. And nowadays we just live in a world where
you're like, oh yeah, so they're doing that thing. That's cool.
Yeah. Well, and it made me think or take a moment to contemplate how much the world of today looks like the portrayed future of you know, this multicultural, libertarian, anarcho, capitalist, insane asylum, a little bit close to what we're actually doing right now.
Pushing away to find new room away from the Alliance Center. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm enjoying it very, very much. And I hope everyone else is going along with the ride for us.
Thanks everybody for hanging out with us. This has been a lovely episode of Spoiler in Time. We hope you enjoyed it too. Those of you who support us on Patreon got it early. Thank you so much for your support. If you would like to get it on Mondays instead of Wednesdays, you can support us too at patreon.com/cordkillers. We'll see you next time.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.